Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with me, Tim Sylvie, and Tomo F1, who's standing in for Harry Benjamin while he's out on commentary duties. This is the place where we meet a figure from the world of motorsport and dive into their lives and careers, often uncovering truths you never knew existed. We've sat down with Formula One drivers, team principals, touring car stars, Le Mans and IndyCar winners, famous broadcasters, content creators and pioneers, all to make sure that you get behind the visor and hear from the world's biggest and most interesting names. If there's anyone with a story to tell, they usually tell it right here. Check us out at motormouth.club, download our app, check out our regular Motormouth kart race where you can race alongside the stars and support our partners at Movember and the Brain Tumor Charity. And don't forget, please subscribe to our show, leave a review, it really makes a difference. Find us on all the major podcast channels. In the meantime, sit back, relax, and enjoy the chat. Hello, Tim Sylvie here, and today we're joined by a man who was born in Sao Paulo in 1984. And did you know, Tom, that Sao Paulo, the capital of Brazil's largest state, which is also called Sao Paulo, is home to more than 41 million people, which is a ridiculous statistic. But, Thomas, a couple of quick-fire Brazilian-esque questions for you to test your knowledge. Are you ready? So, first
question. Come on, then.
What is the capital city of Brazil?
I think it's Brasilia, isn't it?
Yeah!
Come on, geography's my specialist subject, mate. It was always going to be easy, that one. Come on, Tim, do better.
Okay. What is the most typical form of music in Brazil?
okay. Oh, I have absolutely.
I'll give you
no idea.
A, samba, B, flamenco, or C, the tango.
Oh, I haven't watched Strictly Come Dancing for a while. I'm going to say the samba.
Yes, you're doing very well. 2 out of 2.
Knowledge, love it.
Last one for you. This is hard. If you get this, I'll be impressed. Brazil is bordered with all countries in South America. Except for which two? Is it Bolivia and Peru, Uruguay and Paraguay, or Chile and Ecuador?
Well, I'm pretty sure it doesn't border Chile, so I'm going to say Chile and Ecuador.
Absolutely horribly right. It's. Do you know what?
I need to get a map up. I need to get a map.
You're
up.
Right.
Because
I'm right.
Sure it doesn't.
I take it back.
Was that right?
Yeah, Chile and Ecuador.
Yes.
You're absolutely
Come
right.
Come on.
Yeah, that was my fault. I hold my hands up. I thought you were wrong. You were correct. 3 out of 3. I'm seriously impressed, Tom. Well done.
No faith, Tim. No faith.
I'm going to catch you out one of these days. Right, shall we introduce today's guest?
Let's do it, mate. Let's go.
So today we're joined by Lucas Degrassi. He's a man at the cutting edge of electric mobility. He's the winner of the first ever Formula E race in Beijing in 2014 and is the most successful driver in the history of the championship. He's been involved in the series since the start, working alongside the likes of Alejandro Agag, Susie Wolf, Jerome D'Ambrosio. And his journey to the top of motorsport has seen him compete in karts, GP2, Le Mans, Formula E, and of course, Formula One. We'll touch on all of that and the new 24 race F1 calendar, which has just been released. He's a man that's pioneered autonomous racing and co-founder of the recently launched eScooter Championship. We're here to talk about his life, career, thoughts and opinions. Lucas, a big warm welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
Hello, guys. Thank you very much for having me here. And it's a big pleasure to join the podcast.
Lucas, thank you so much, man. Where are you joining us from today? Your background's not giving too much away, although I love that helmet. That looks really cool.
Yeah, that's last year's helmet. I'm home. I live in Monaco. I've been living here for the past 12 years, since my time in Formula One. And this is my home since I left. Actually, I moved from Brazil to the UK and then from the UK here.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, first of all, let's start with where it all began, which we typically start with the guests. Where did the racing bug first hit you, Lucas, when you were younger?
The bug really bit me when Ayrton Senna died. I think that was the moment that I realized that those racing cars that I used to watch when I was very little, and then I did the same playing Mario Kart on Nintendo, was actually the making a big impact for the Brazilian people. And I was young, I was 9 years old. I had my first few experiences with go-kart, but it was something like another sport that I did. I liked football, I liked skateboard, I liked surfing, I liked everything. And go-karting, actually, I started doing this because I had older cousins that would take me to the go-kart, rental go-kart, and I used to play around a little bit, and I was starting to do some more serious racing there. But after Senna died, I was like, okay, I want to become a professional racing driver. I want to at least have a small percentage of this impact that he had. And then as soon as I started to put more effort into it, you start having better results, you like it more, and then the snowball just grew from there.
What was it like at that period? I mean, you were still relatively young at the time when Ayrton Senna passed away, but what was the vibe like? How did the country respond to that news? I mean, was it literally a national mourning?
It was at the similar level, and as far as I remember, that when Queen Elizabeth died last week. So we had 3 days of bank holiday in Brazil. There were like this parade, people were queuing for kilometers to say goodbye to Senna. He was like an idol from Brazil. It was a difficult time in the country. We were like hit by mass inflation, poverty, but everybody woke up in the morning to watch the Formula One races because of him. So he was also helping with education. I am sure if he would be alive, he would be doing something in a grander scale, maybe in politics or something like this, or a minister. So he was very involved with the country. So he was a huge loss for everybody. And I remember my family crying. I remember I was crying. You know, I didn't even know exactly why I was crying about, but everybody was crying. It was something very emotional. I remember exactly, like hour by hour, what happened since my father calling me and said there was an accident. I was not watching the race. I was actually playing with my RC airplanes in a little bit further away. And then I went back home and stayed in front of the TV for the rest of the afternoon. So it was a huge impact.
Yeah, because it's the thing with Senna is that there were many Brazilian drivers in Formula One before him. There's been many after. But there was clearly something about him that seemed to kind of captivate. Would you say, because again, there'd been successful Brazilian drivers before, but I guess was it that the combination of his success, but also all of the stuff he did off track that really made him you know, such, because it's one thing being, you know, famous for being an F1 driver, but Senna just seemed to captivate people on a whole new level.
Yeah, I think he was, he made many breakthroughs on the sport of Formula One. So Formula One success largely, not largely, but a big part of it is due to these iconic people that actually have been through the years. And Senna was completely an outlier on the sense that the way he marketed himself, the way he positioned himself, the fight he had on track, he was very aggressive on track. He took a lot of risk. He was aggressive off track. You know, there was a lot of incidents. He left. He went against FIA. You know, there was a lot of stories. So I think he was an iconic piece, and he excelled not only on track but outside of the racetrack, and on top of it, in his social and his love for Brazil, carrying the flag all the time, you know, being proud of being Brazilian. I think that was unique, and it changed the how Brazilians they saw the sport.
Now let's bring it back to you. Let's fast forward through your career to Formula One. It was 2004 when you bagged your role as a reserve driver for the Renault Formula One team. How did that first opportunity with them come about?
In 2004, I joined the Renault Driver Development Program called the RDB with the likes of Kovalainen, Kubica, Loic Duval, Frank Montagny, and some others, Jerome D'Ambrosio later on, Guido van der Garde, Romain Grosjean later on. So I joined this program, and in 2004 I left university. So basically, I quit university in Brazil, and in Brazil I've been doing like go karting and Formula up to Formula Renault, which was like Formula 4 back then. And I took my bags and I moved to UK, and I did British Formula 3 as part of the program. My first test with Formula One would happen 1 year later, after I won the Macau Grand Prix in Formula 3. Was a very special podium because second place was Kubica and third place was Vettel back then. And I got my first Formula One test. That was end of 2005. Was with the V10s and the late development of the car that would be champion that year of Alonso, and testing in Jerez. Then I continued the development 2006 and 2007, doing some straight line and tests. And then in 2008, I became the reserve driver for Renault, 2008 and 2009. And 2010, I did my race season in Virgin Racing.
So what do you remember about that that Macau Grand Prix? Because obviously that was a grid packed with, again, Kubica and Vettel, 2 and 3, you won. Like, how did qualifying go? What do you kind of remember about the race?
Yeah, I was... So Kubica was coming with Tom's Japanese Formula, because the Macau Grand Prix is like the world championship of Formula 3. So there is Formula 3 coming from all over. Back then, it was like there was no international Formula 3. There was the local Formula 3s, like Euro Series, South American, Japanese, French, German. And then everybody would go to the Macau race. That was the most difficult track, the most dangerous track. So we would go there and race. And the year before was my rookie year in Macau, in 2004. And I finished third. Second was Kubica, and the first was Prema. Alexander Prema, which later would be the teammate of Hamilton in Formula 2. But then in that second year, I qualified, I think, eighth in the pre-final. And then on the pre-final, I started eighth, finished fifth. And then on the final, I started fifth, got to the lead. I overtook Kubica down the straight. Then after, got overtaken back. Then I was second for pretty much the whole race, up to the moment there was a safety car. A bit like the Verstappen-Hamilton situation. I was second, and there was a safety car. The safety car restarted with 2 laps to go. So on the restart, Macau has a very long straight, the longest straight in Formula 3, something like 2 kilometers straight. A bit like the Spa or Rouge and the back straight, a little bit longer than that. So I got in the slipstream, I passed it Kubica, managed to open a small gap, held him up in the last lap and won the Macau race. So that was it was the first Brazilian to win since, I think, Senna or somebody. It was back then for my career was huge. Was how I came up on the spotlight, let's say. And then I got my first Formula One test because of that.
It's mad, that race. It's such an important race in a driver's career. And if you win it, it makes such a big difference. It sort of feels like it doesn't get enough. I think if you're a motorsport fan, or you're in the industry, or you love your racing, you know about that race. If you're your sort of armchair F1 fan, you don't really know about it. It seems a shame that it's not got more publicity, because some of the names that have won that, and it's such a challenging race. And like you say, it's a dangerous track, and we've seen some horrific accidents there. Who was that girl that took off and went into the
comments? Sophia Flores, wasn't it? Yeah.
Oh my God. I mean, accidents like that are just terrifying. But no, massive kudos for you for winning that race. Well, let's
and also there was the GT crash.
The huge pileup, yeah.
Insane.
Yeah, if you see that pileup and you see one car on top of everybody, that's my car actually. By the way, that's the number.
Oh yeah, of course.
Reckless.
I completely forgot about that.
Reckless. Causing chaos on the streets of Macau. Now you mentioned Virgin there. You stepped up to Virgin as a full-blown F1 driver. Can you remember the emotions and that feeling when you first sat on the grid, put your foot to the floor and took off? Just before we get into that, bear with me for 2 minutes. I must tell you about our new sponsors of the show, and it's one that means a great deal to us all on a very personal level here at the Motor Mouth Podcast. In 2021, Dana, the founder of Motus One, passed away suddenly and without warning whilst visiting family in the States. Dana was one of my very best friends. The legacy he left with his family and his business is incredible, and I'm hugely humbled and proud to have his booming business as part of this show. Sponsors are vital for our survival, and make sure we continue to bring you interviews with the biggest names in racing. So if you or your company needs event transportation, look no further than the team at Motus One. They have you covered anywhere in the world, from a single chauffeur-driven sedan to a fleet of luxury SUVs, Teslas, or motor coaches. Find your transportation solution with Motus One. They've got offices worldwide, including the Middle East, Europe, and Africa, and will support your transportation needs regardless of location. Motus One is committed to world-class service at the very best rates to ensure your event goes off without a hitch. Contact them at motusone.com. We'll put all their social links in the podcast description. A massive, massive thanks to Dana, his wife Claudia, his kids, the rest of the Motus One team. Thank you for having faith in our show and joining us for season 12. Right, back to it. On with the show.
To be 100% honest with you, it was great. When I signed my contract and I knew I would be in Formula One and I did the announcement, it was like a sentiment of mission accomplished, you know, to reach Formula One, which was my dream. It's pretty much every racing driver dream to be there on the grid. And first race, I was, of course, nervous, but the car itself had so many problems. We had so much stuff to resolve that actually my mind was just trying to fix the problems that we had on the car. The fuel tank was not big enough. We were completely overweight. There was so many, the brakes were overheating, the gearbox was leaking. I mean, there was like, and then I was like, I was almost sure we're not going to finish the race because it was during testing season. We almost didn't do a full race before that. So I knew that we were going to struggle massively.
But Lucas, sorry to interrupt you mid-flow. How does that happen with an F1, a relatively modern F1 team? I know it's, you know, I know there are lots of different reasons, but how can it get to a point where you're on the grid and you're thinking about all these issues that just haven't been addressed? Is it financial? Was it the quality of staff? What causes it?
To build up a Formula One team, it's like building up a company. It's almost like asking somebody, okay, now you're going to make, let's say a good analogy, a car or a bicycle or whatever good that you want to make as a company. It takes time to put the right people in the right place, to create a culture inside the company, to create a dynamic And to build a Formula One car, or to build any race car from scratch, it requires a huge amount of engineering. And of course, you're trying to take that engineering to the extreme level. And that's why, for example, an analogy, that's why you see so much reliability problems with Ferrari now, because they're pushing the performance. And then when you push performance, you try to make the parts lighter, then the parts break. You try to make the gearbox as thin as possible and with least, the least amount of friction as possible. But because you've never done that in the past, it's the first time you're building a Formula One car, you take a lot of things wrong. You take a lot of assumptions which are not the correct ones. And it's literally nobody's fault. You can put all the money you want. I give you the example of Honda. With experience, they took the even Mercedes, with experience, with all the money in the world, takes years for you to make a competitive engine. It takes years to make a competitive car. And it's not because of the lack of money. It's basically the whole ecosystem and the culture of making such a complex machinery as a race car. And it's not only Formula One. You can argue that for, let's say, a sports car, a GT, even to a production line car. So that was the problem. Well, the problem was the first year. Of course, there is a lot of incompetences also on top of it, like not calculating the right size of fuel tank or putting the pump in the wrong place. This is something basic that, okay, you probably would fire the guy that did that, but in the grand scheme of things, it's there was a lot of things that could have done better, and it's basically lack of experience.
And obviously, you're hired to that team as a driver, but there's so much more that, not just in terms of kind of car setup, but also, you know, being a presence in the garage and understanding that, I guess, business and commercial side, and the team being able to say to you, look, Lucas, we don't have a competitive car at the moment. All of that stuff outside of the car, has that always been something of interest to you? Because I imagine there's a lot of drivers who just turn up and they're not really interested. They just want to be given a quick car. They just want to drive. They don't really care about the other stuff. Do you find interest in the other, the more business, the more kind of commercial sides of the sport as well?
The beautiful thing about motorsport is that it's one of the only sports in the world that combines entertainment and technology development that actually will change the world. If you look at football, it's great entertainment, but it doesn't really change anything. The sport has been probably very similar for the past 100 years. Motorsport has the power to change mobility and change technology for the better. And when technology evolves, it's always the general tendency is for the better. So racing has changed, has shaped the mobility world and the technology we use today and the safety and the sustainability we have today was partly due because of motorsport pushing and engineers pushing the boundary of race. So for me, motorsport is a platform to, of course, to have entertainment, to win races, to do what we love, to talk about what we love, but also to promote businesses and to promote the technology. And this is always, this has always been on my mind. Of course, I love the sport and I'm there to win races. But I always seen that as a possibility to push this, to push these boundaries and to push these points forward through motorsport. So I'm very deep into the technology. I'm very interested about the business, how the system works, how the car works, how to make up a team, a company. And I know that racing is going to only be part of my life. There will be a second, third part of my life that will be not inside the car, outside of the car, doing something else. So I try to learn as much as I can in the most vast array of possibilities that I can.
Now, let's dive a bit deeper into the sustainability side of things. In terms of sustainability and specifically climate change, where does Formula One sit in that landscape and where does its future lie? Does it have a future? You know, we know Formula E has this exclusivity to single-seater electric racing for a number of years. They're going green as quickly as they can. There's teams going completely carbon neutral. Is Formula One keeping up? Does it have a place in 20, 25 years in motor racing?
The short answer is yes. But sustainability has many different sides. And for me personally, sustainability is not about eating tofu and hugging trees. Sustainability is about how do we improve technology and how do we improve the quality of lives of people for the better? How do you provide mobility to people in the UK, which are going to go through an energy crisis this winter? How do you provide cheaper mobility for Africa and South America? This is all related to the technologies that we are developing racing and the technology that, and everything that we are pushing forward. In terms of pure racing and where the sport positions itself, it's very important to have a future. And Formula One is in a crossroad, which it doesn't really know how to make this transition towards electric and if it needs to make this transition towards electric. If we look 100 years in the future, to not have any argument about time frames, everything is going to be electric. So the source of these electrons going around, the general tendency of humanity is to go from low energy and low density power machines to high energy, high density, high efficient machines. We go from, let's say, a horse, which eats a lot and caused a lot of sustainable problems. Actually, just a short parenthesis in the middle of this story, the sustainability problem of Manhattan in New York was there were too many horses and they were shitting everywhere. And there was a huge plague of rats and stuff because there were too many horses for the tiny island there is. And the internal combustion engine solved this problem. So actually, sustainability moved forward from horses actually to internal combustion engines. So people saying, we should ride horses. Actually, we can't. You can't 8 billion people around the world ride horses.
We'll be swimming in horse shit.
Sorry?
We'll be swimming in horse shit. There'll be no escape.
Exactly. So actually, we move from low energy, low density machines to high energy and high density machines. And internal combustion engine has a thermodynamic limit that it cannot extract more energy out of from combustion out of a certain limit, which is related to temperature. So there is a limit it can go. Electric engines, on the upper hand, they are almost 100% efficient. So the Formula E motors, they are 98% efficient. The problem is the energy source, which is the great discussion. Is the battery, will be a fuel cell, it could be nuclear fusion that release alpha particles that creates an electric current. It doesn't matter, but electric motors will be the future. So everything that moves will be electric. On top of it, electric motors, they don't create pollution on site. So you can say, but we can run on biofuel, like Formula One is going to biofuel now. Perfect. Biofuel it's actually works for climate change because the net total carbon is neutral. The plants, they get carbon here, you burn carbon there, the net is zero. But if you're cycling behind a car that is running on biofuel or even e-fuel, you're still going to get the same pollution as a normal car running on fossil fuels because the molecule is the same. The combustion process creates a lot of pollutants. So there is the difference of sustainability between pollution and climate change, which also are separated topics. So it's very hard for Formula One at the moment, the most dense-packed energy-powered machines we have, they are internal combustion engines. They are actually jet engines from aeroplanes and also the highly sophisticated internal combustion engines from F1 cars. They cannot go battery electric, but it's because of battery, not because of the motor itself. Yeah. In terms of power-to-weight ratio, the electric motor has a higher power to weight ratio than a combustion engine already. The problem is when you put together with the battery, it doesn't. So planes, they're not going to go electric very soon. You cannot, there is no technology to make planes electric, especially intercontinental flights. Short flights.
Yeah, there's only like tiny planes that they've like 4-seat capacity, which is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But not international ones. So Formula One is in this crossroad. It needs to cut pollution, it needs to seem as sustainable, but they don't have the technology to actually do what they do today with the new level of technology. So they do they wait longer? Do they transition faster? In my opinion, personally, they could eventually continue to develop internal combustion engines because internal combustion engines will stay in the world for the next 10, 20, 30 years because it will be needed for aeroplanes. Mm. It will be needed for some specific areas. There are use cases for internal combustion. Or they can only say, or they can also say, look, we will be entertainment only, like NASCAR, and we don't care about the sustainability part. We're going to develop sustainability in lightweight materials. So we're going to make the car very light because developing lightweight and strong materials, that will contribute for a sustainable future for Earth. So you could argue about sustainability in many different ways, only on the energy source. Yeah. You could say, look, Formula One can go V10 with biofuel made in Brazil, sugarcane fuel made in Brazil, which they, now Formula One will have 10% of. IndyCar run it 100%. When I started go-karting, 96, I run 100%. Because ethanol actually has more octanes per unit than gasoline, so it creates more power. Has less energy density, but has more power. My point is, there are many, there is a lot of nuances and the discussion is very profound. And there is many ways for you to position yourself. What we cannot have is greenwashing.
Yeah.
Saying, we're going to be sustainable. In the end, we are not.
Yeah.
They just released the calendar.
More
they calculated 170,000 kilometers of flights. More than 96% of the carbon footprint of the whole Formula One series is the traveling. It's not the car. Mm-hmm. So if the car is V10, is V8, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I want to argue. It's not very simple to say it is sustainable or not. There are many different ways of communicating and developing and progressing the sport forward.
Because we're still very much in that discovery phase. Because even with lithium-ion batteries in electric cars, it's the precious metals that are being used. They need to be mined. So there's like that. There's so many different ways. And I guess with whether it's Formula E or Extreme or E1 series,
on this topic. So just to finish the let's say a little bit of the nerdy side of the technology.
I love this. This is great.
So the batteries, the new batteries are 100% recyclable. So you just melt them up. You just need energy. But if considering you have energy, they are 100% recyclable. You can take
them. Are these solid state or lithium ion?
No, the lithium ion.
Okay.
100%. So basically, the lithium ion is not made of lithium, neither ion. They are made of nickel. And nickel is as abundant on Earth as iron. I mean, we can do batteries for the next 1 billion years with the amount of nickel we have on Earth. So then basically the batteries are made largely of nickel. And then we have some graphite on the anode. And the cathode is basically is NMC, it's nickel, manganese, cobalt. The problem is the manganese and cobalt. The cobalt is mined mainly in Africa. Africa is very unstable. Actually, if Africa was politically stable, it would be the best thing for Africa because we would buy cobalt for them and we would send money to Africa, we'd develop Africa. But it's not. So there's a lot of problems with cobalt. The new batteries of lithium ion with NMC, they have a NMC content of only 10% cobalt on the cathode, which it's very little on the battery. And the new ones, the one that Tesla announced, has only nickel. Doesn't have the cobalt, neither the manganese. But this is not the battery that will go in the cars. The new batteries, the cheaper ones, is the nickel iron phosphate. So pretty much the battery is made out of iron. And iron, it's the same iron that you build bridges or homes or whatever. So requires energy to make batteries, requires. The batteries are heavy, they are. But they are fully recyclable. They are not pollutant at all. And as far as they are, there is a process to discard them. And these batteries, the nickel iron phosphate, they are worse than the lithium ion, but they are much cheaper and they're much easier and safer to do. And this is the first stage. Then you go to the second stage, is solid state. And solid state is more or less the same, but instead of having a liquid in the middle, you have like a gel that conducts the ion to move from the cathode to the anode through to the membrane. And then the third generation of batteries is graphene. And graphene is carbon. It's basically 2D carbon structure. And then the potential is 100 times the energy we have now. They already in laboratory, you can do small scale, but then it's basically carbon, and carbon you have everywhere. So as far as you can make graphene in large scale, you'll be able to do the batteries of graphene. There is problem of controllability, anyway, production methods, but anyway, it will come. It's just a matter of time.
A very quick interruption to remind you to check out our sponsors, Motus One, the event transportation company. Motus One is the...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Industry leader in complex transport management, from hospitality, talent, production crews, VIPs, and artist transport, Motus One's team have got you covered. They've also launched their leading-edge cloud-based event transportation management system called Motus Ride. Now you can manage your entire event transport program digitally. Make bookings, allocate rides, create approval processes, see reports, track costs, loads more. Head over to motus1.com and hear how they can support your event transportation needs. Back to the show. Lucas, do you think there's an element of Formula One trying to pull the wool over our eyes slightly? I've just pulled up the sustainability report, which anyone can access online from Formula One. And as you rightly say, that the power emission unit, the statistic is actually 0.7% of the annual emissions come from the power unit itself, with event operations at 7.3%, logistics 45%, facilities and factories 19%, and business travel 27%. So the car is actually having a really minimal impact. But that feels like the message that we get publicly is we've got to sort the car out, need to sort the car out. That'll trickle down into our everyday lives. No one really talks vocally from a fan perspective about the logistics. Do you think this is a purposeful tactic from Formula One, or is this just, I don't know, a lack of understanding and education elsewhere in the sport?
I think people are not very interested if you talk about sustainability with logistics. And I just tweeted today, if you want to make motorsport sustainable and create a problem for the engineers to solve, for example, you could come up with a rule that the freight weight needs to reduce 5% every year. And then you have to come up with these clever ideas. How do I make the parts lighter? How do I make the tools lighter? Like, so actually the freight, which is the biggest impact in sustainability, becomes 5% lighter every day. This will be a much, much bigger impact than anything else on the sustainability side. And the other fallacy that is commonly used is that the engines, from the Formula One are extremely efficient, over 50%. They are only efficient as the, and they say it's the most efficient engine in the world, which is not the case. The most efficient engine in the world are from large ships, are the two-stroke diesel engines. They are the most efficient engines. They rev at 40 RPM. You can see the piston going up and down, but they are, but because they are so slow and because there is this, they are huge. They are the most. They are actually a gas turbine that produces electricity is even more efficient than this. It's also internal combustion in a way, but they are fixed. But the reason why they say that the Formula One engine is so efficient is because they have this incredibly expensive and complex system to harvest energy, like the two CURS systems, plus complex materials, extremely complex solutions within the engine that will never go to a commercial product. It's too expensive. It's too fragile. It's too expensive. We'll never go there. So saying that the technology of the engine, we will see that in the car, is also not true. We are reaching like a limit on the thermodynamic limit that we can extract mechanical power from the combustion, from the chemical combustion that happens inside the engine. It is true that we increase this efficiency massively with higher pressure, higher temperature, better materials, but it is 50%. We'll never reach 70. And electric engines are already at 98.5, sometimes 99. So, that's the difference.
I just think that the, like I was saying about like the, it's almost the gamification where you've got Formula E, you've got Extreme E, you've got E1, the boats, you've got all of these different series kind of tackling this problem. And again, like you said, kind of combining the sport with the engineering challenge, and I think that's really going to push things forward. But yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. Like the if F1 wants to make an actual change and not just be perceived to be making a change, it needs to do. I mean, this 24 race calendar. I mean, a lot of people have made suggestions of how they can, you know, tighten things up and have less traveling. We're still going from, I think we're going from Baku to Miami and then back to Europe again. I think, aren't we, Tim? Yeah. Have you got it up? Because it's crazy.
Yeah, the routes are bonkers, and they often. But like we said before, Tom, it comes down to in F1, it comes down to commercials. Like if it's not commercially or economically viable for them to go from close country and come back to the UK, they'll do it because it money talks.
But it's fine to do it. So I on the same tweet as I said about the calendar and the freight, I said, look, the easiest thing. So if you look at Formula One as another business in the world, because if you look at the whole impact of Formula One in overall emissions worldwide, it's tiny as well. So if you compare this with the whole world. But what is very interesting is that Formula One could just be 100% carbon neutral tomorrow if they buy carbon credits. So carbon credits is a very unknown concept. So basically carbon credits, it's basically trying to level out different business and different emissions to a same goal. So if one business is very carbon dense, it needs to buy a lot of carbon credits. If another business is already very efficient and doesn't emit that much carbon, it doesn't need to buy carbon credits. So you're basically trying to compare apples with apples across many different businesses worldwide. So actually F1 could start just buying carbon credits. And at one point, exactly as the point that Tim said now, at one point, the carbon credit will be so expensive that these 24 race calendars will make no sense economically anymore. So the pressure is actually not on F1, but on every single business summed to have the best impact. And as soon as the carbon credit becomes more expensive, these businesses are forced economically to try to solve this conundrum of reducing the carbon footprint. So we put an economic pressure on deciding something like the calendar. It's not up to the regulatory bodies or to Formula One to say, I'm not going to do this or that. They're going to do what's best for them, and everybody do what's best for them. But if there is a common sense across countries, a worldwide system of carbon credit that is concise and strict and regulated, different business will adapt. And as soon as this starts to become more expensive, business will make more sustainable decisions. And Formula One could be tomorrow carbon neutral if they buy whatever, 1 million carbon credits that will cost for them $10 million, which is nothing. And then they will be fully carbon neutral straight away.
Yeah, it's a fascinating and a huge subject. And it's one that stirs emotion, doesn't it? It's hard not to get sort of angry about it in a way. And it's hard not to argue against electric power. You know, some of the things you were saying there, you know, you see the stuff around biofuels and Formula One and more efficient engines and new stuff coming in 2026. And you sort of go, you sort of nod along and think, yeah, you go, Formula One, that's great. But when you get into the weeds of it and you start to understand it and you realize that actually it's all a bit smoke and mirrors and, you know, it sort of gets you a bit frustrated. Anyway, listen, let's talk more about you. We've taken up loads of your time already, but we want to get into your career a little bit as well. In recent history, Formula E, you were racing for Rocket Venturi Racing, soon to be Maserati Racing in season 9. You worked with some terrific people there, Jerome D'Ambrosio, Susie Wolf. How do you look back on your time at Rocket Venturi Racing?
Great. I had a big transition year between Audi, which I stayed for a decade racing for them, from the golden era of sports car in LMP1 hybrid with more than 1,000 horsepower. And then we made the transition to Formula E. So I stayed with them for 10 years until they decided now to go to Formula One, in which I could not stay with them anymore. And then this year with Rocket Venturi was a bit of a challenge because it was the last year of this Gen 2 car. And Venturi was, it's a small team, but with very good people. And we managed to take the team to the second place in the championship. And I started after the half of the season to get my stuff together and start delivering consistent podiums and results, because it takes a little bit of time to create this culture with the engineer. You know, the other day I was talking to a friend and I used this analogy. You know, when you know somebody so well that you go to the pub and you know already that they cannot have the next beer. You don't even need to ask.
Tom.
Right? You don't even...
How dare you, Tim?
you don't even need to ask. So that's the kind of relationship that you must have with your engineer, with your data engineer, and with the guys around you. You almost like you don't need to speak about it to know what you want.
Yeah.
And that takes time to create in any team. So every time you change teams, there is this process of knowing, of creating the culture, understanding how to communicate. Some people want to be very direct. The other need to be a little bit more polite, or, you know, it depends. So it took me a few months to get up and running with Venturi, but I love the guys there. And we had an amazing time, and the team had an amazing result. Now changes to Maserati. And I had to make the decision in the middle of the year to choose my next challenge. And I choose Mahindra because I think on the longer run, to have somebody with full commitment to Formula E for the next 4 years with full factory support. People don't know the Mahindra group very well, but it's a huge group. It's the size of Mercedes, it's the size of BMW, it's the size of Audi. It's a huge group. So having them is the only racing series they do. It's the only thing that they want to develop. So having them behind gave me a lot of trust to be able to develop a winning culture there.
Yeah, it's Mahindra, as you say, is absolutely enormous company. You know, behind the racing team itself. Dilbert Gill is obviously gone. Is he going to be replaced? Is his position going to be changed? Is it still exist, or is it going to be changed up?
Yes. Yes, he was the team principal and CEO. We now have a new CEO, and there will be a team principal coming along soon. At the moment, hasn't been completely finalized, but it's going the right direction. And Dubak has been a very important. He built Mahindra Racing from scratch. Everybody's very thankful of his time. He will be very missed by everybody there in Formula E and in the team.
And Lucas, now that the Gen 3 car is, you know, it's been shown to the world, and certainly the aesthetics of, you know, it's a bit of Marmite, you love it or hate it. Ultimately, what do you
love
think
it
of
or
the,
hate it?
Come on, Tom.
You know what? I actually like it. I think I like it more
Hang
than
on.
Most people. I
are
think
you,
it looks
are
cool.
Are you actually telling the truth?
I am. I know. It looks like the, what was the thing I said it looks like in Star Wars?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like the Star Wars.
The Destroyer. It does. The Death Star. It looks great. But no, I've got a problem with that. It looks good. But also, from a I guess, technical point of view, like, Lucas, have you seen the car in person? Have you had much experience with it at all physically yet?
Yeah, I drove it. So we were in Varano testing all the manufacturers last week. And this car is a beast. The new Gen 3 car is really, really powerful.
It's got a lot more power, hasn't it? Yeah.
So in general terms, the car is shorter, narrower, about 10 centimeters each. We have 250 kilowatts in the front axle and 350 kilowatt on the rear axle. And this is average power, which is very important to define. Because when you talk about combustion engine, then you say, my car has 1,000 horsepower, you're talking about peak power. And so if you are in fifth gear, and you have 1,000 horsepower, you want to get out of the red light, you can't, because you need to be in the band that you have 1,000 horsepower at 7,000 RPM. Electric motors, they produce this power at any RPM, so it's average. And although for the first season now, in season 9, we're only going to use the rear powertrain to push the car has the potential of four-wheel drive, 600 kilowatts, which means it's more than one horsepower per kilo on average. There is no other racing car on the planet that has this power to weight ratio that Formula E has. And in a car that has very little downforce, because it was designed not to have downforce, and in a tire that was designed not to have so much grip. So the car is traction limited from almost zero to 200 kilometers per hour. And so the car has, if you activate both motors, the car will accelerate faster than a Formula One car or any car, probably just slower than a dragster. Currently, it has an acceleration in a proximity of a Formula Two car, only with the rear axle. The car also is 80 kilos lighter than last season, so it's much more agile. And the only downside of the car, in my view, I'm also not a big fan of the aesthetics. Actually, when the car is naked without the extra bodywork, the car looks amazing. The car is very tiny, very narrow, everything very compact. I mean, the electric motor that generates the 450 horsepower, it's literally not much bigger than this box. Wow. It's probably two boxes of those.
Mad.
So it's really will be the same motor that powers the Formula One cars in 2026. I think. Yeah. So same power, 350 kilowatts. So the car is a beast. On the racing side, changes completely because it looks like we're gonna do a pit stop to recharge part of the battery at very high power. You have brake by wire in both axles. We don't have mechanical brakes at the rear. So 100% of the rear brakes happens with engine braking. So the same engine braking that you have when you go downhill, let's say on a normal car that you see that sign on the motorway, keep your gear engaged. You have only rear braking engine, so you don't have a disc. So that creates a completely brake by software feeling in the car. And also having the front powertrain, having the front drive shaft, means that it's very weird to drive because you have forces acting in the differential in a way that when you turn and you lock the inside wheel, because of the differential forces, sometimes the inside wheel spins to the other side. So you're going to a corner with the inside wheel spinning reverse, and it's very weird.
What
and then,
the hell? My brain.
That sounds dangerous.
My brain is melting.
And because you have a higher mass in the front axle because of this, when you lock the wheel, it takes much more time to unlock it. So to miss a corner is also much easier. And the car has the grip stayed in the level that it was, and the power now is much higher. So it will be a much more critical car to drive in terms of...
Sounds like fun, though.
It does sound like it'll be good. Do you know what? The only car that I can think of that is even comparable to this right now from the electric world is that McMurtry thing that Max Chilton drove. That thing carries some serious speed. That is fast.
But that's very interesting concept, because it creates downforce from a static...
It has two tons pressure. When it stood still.
It creates a pressure differential. Yeah. So actually how aerodynamic works, because of the airspeed, you create a pressure differential between the surface in the top and the surface in the bottom. So what this McMurtry do, basically just accelerate the air, or you take the air out from the bottom, so you create static pressure. So that car has a lot of grip. Yeah. And it's a machine. I was in Goodwood actually when the car was there. I was driving one of these... classic cars, electrified from Arrival, was amazing. But I was very impressed with what that car could do. And Formula E is different because the grip level is on purpose very low for the power it has. So we could have gone easily 3, 4, 5 seconds quicker with a traditional soft racing tire compound and a little bit more of a wing and downforce. But they don't want to do that because they want to keep the car as harder it is possible to drive. And trust me, the car will be very, very hard to drive.
Yeah, I bet. Do you still, when it came out, when did they release it? It was Monaco, wasn't it? Season 8, they released the car. And I follow you on LinkedIn, and I read your article about how you would have designed, not necessarily, you know, the technical aspects or the engineering, but how you would have designed the car. And it looked very different. Now that you've had time to spend some time with the Gen 3, do you still stand by those points that you made, or would you retract any?
100% to the points that I made. And actually, I'm pushing for that design to be in Gen 4 because it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. At the moment, it makes no sense to have the battery as a cube behind the driver. The battery needs to be on the floor of the car. So my proposal is to be a U-shape that you can actually move the driver a little bit backwards and the weight distribution a little bit forwards, so you can have a better distribution front to rear axle, and therefore have more power at the front. I want to use 4 tires the same, so you can exchange tires between front and rear. That is, for example, a sustainability point that does not interfere with anything. If you're able to change front tires with rear, you just need to carry one type of tire. You don't need to carry two types, front and rear tires, for example. And I want to use the same powertrain rear and front, so the manufacturers, they can use the same powertrain rear and front. So I hope the Gen 4 car can have these shapes. I would love for the car to have movable aerodynamic devices controlled by software. So like a DRS that you can open and close everywhere on track as you wish, front and rear, but in a much big, grander scale. I want the full car to be controlled by movable aerodynamic devices. I mean, there is a lot of things to evolve. Even, for example, rear wheel steering. There is no reason why racing cars, they don't have active rear wheel steering. Actually, that would make a huge difference in terms of lap time if you were able to actually, because the modern cars, they all have rear wheel steer. So also having a rear wheel steering, it's kind of simple in engineering terms to do. You just basically have a changeable toe link solenoid that can change the toe link according to your steering angle, whatever you want to.
That all sounds very sensible, almost too sensible. I don't know why they haven't done it already, Tim. Why are they just little Lucas? I don't get it.
Well, what I'm reading from this is Lucas on a 1-year contract, then going into management at Formula E and
surely
Gen 4 cars. Now
I would love to follow up my career in something like this. I you see how passionate I am about engineering, and if not in racing, will be in something else. But that probably is the next step.
I love it. It's fascinating. Now, we're going to let you go in a minute, but I have to squeeze in a couple of listener questions that have been sent in. Otherwise, I'll get told off. Right. I've got some good ones here. I'm going to try and keep them to the quicker ones. This is from Cord CL16. Out of all the categories you've raced in F1, endurance, Formula E, which one is the most challenging? One word answer.
Each one presents its own challenge. It's very hard to pick something which is the most challenging, and also depends on a lot of factors. So I'll have to say that it depends so much that I can't pick one.
Fine, firmly on the fence. Another question from actually the same guy, which I love. I think a great question. Favorite fruit?
Favorite fruit?
Yes.
Is coconut a fruit?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think it's a fruit.
Probably. I don't know what else it'd be.
It's got to be a fruit.
It's not a vegetable, so.
I hate coconuts. Like bounties, those bounties.
Really?
Oh, I hate coconuts. I really hate them. Okay, one more.
It's great.
One more of our listener ones. Great question, Imi Cousins. What series that you've raced in has the best style steering wheel? Yes.
The best style steering wheel?
Yeah.
That's
got him.
Tricky question. Trying to remember.
Because I still don't like the Williams F1 one where they don't have the screen attached.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they've got the screen solid, haven't they?
Yeah.
And then they're the only team that has that in F1.
It's like a Skoda.
But I understand why they would have that, because it actually reduces the mass.
It does, so
yeah. It's easier to the driver to actually to steer, but at the same time, you cannot look when you're turning. So.
And the Formula E steering wheel has, you have your regen on your hands, is that right?
We have, we probably will not going to have the regen anymore in Gen 3
right.
As in the hand, but we have 6 pedals on the back and about 12 buttons in the front and another 5 click switches that you can choose 12 functions.
Yeah. Blimey.
It's complicated. Well, let's go with Formula E, seeing as you're in it, as the best steering wheel. We're going to move to our final three because we've kept you nearly double the length that we were supposed to. And I expect Liv, who's one of your PR team, is getting crossed.
To be honest, it's been a great talk. So take
your time. In that case, have you got any hidden talents?
Hidden?
Talents. Like, what are you good at outside of racing and business? What's your thing? Can you sing? Got any language? Any other? Well, languages, obviously.
No, actually music and arts, not at all. Something which I could be at home. I cook.
Okay.
That's maybe a small hidden talent, but I'm not very good at it. So I'll have to say, flying RC counts, because actually I'm very good at it.
Okay.
Nice. I like that. What's your favorite meal to cook? I want to know now. What's your speciality?
Got to be a steak.
So my favorite food is sushi. It's Japanese. But what I normally cook the most is barbecue. So like a grilled barbecue, and in Brazil when you do it's called the churrasco, right? You put all the meats and you grill them. That's what I normally when I cook something like this.
Lovely. Get the caipirinhas going. By the way, if you ever find yourself in central Bedfordshire in the UK where I live. There's a place down this sounds creepy, doesn't it? This is going somewhere. There's a place down the road from where I live called the Shuttleworth Collection, which is an incredible collection of pre- and post-war aircraft. But the reason I mention it is because they have amazing RC aeroplane flying shows there, and it's full of people flying, not your typical aeroplane. I mean, these things are ginormous, like passenger, you could sit in them. They're huge. They're like passenger jets and fighter planes, stunt planes, everything. It's amazing. You should Google it. You'll be right up your nerdy RC.
How far is it from Banbury?
Oh, not far. 40 minutes down the road.
Okay. So maybe one time that I'll be on the simulator there, I can come back.
You'd love it. The Shuttleworth collection. Right, we do have a final three questions, which are brought to us by our friends at Motus One, our current podcast sponsors. Go check them out for all your Formula One and other motorsport transportation needs. Tomo, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. Lucas, what's got you excited at the moment? Could be inside of motorsport, could be outside of motorsport.
Currently, the thing that got me most excited is seeing my child develop. So seeing their algorithm coming to work.
Love that. Great question. A great answer to a great question. Number two, how much of your success is down to luck and right place, right time, and how much is down to other things?
I really think that luck over many decisions that you do in your life, they tend to level out. I was extremely lucky sometimes, like winning the first race of Formula E, and I was extremely unlucky some other times, like my gearbox breaking down in the leading the race in Monza in GP2 fighting for the title. It would have made my career in a different way, would have changed stuff. I don't know, but overall, I think you have to think that the success of someone, or at least your success, has to be on average due to your own work and to your own how much you push things forward. You cannot... if you believe in luck, I think it's an excuse not to work hard enough, if you know what I mean.
Lucas, what are you scared of?
That something happens with my children. I think that's what I'm most scared of.
Yeah, I had a feeling that wasn't going to be spiders or something.
I am afraid of spiders also, but as far as the spiders are coming in my direction, actually, I will sort them out.
I've got one more question as well, the little Tomo question at the very end. A lot of Brazilian junior talent coming through. Obviously, Felipe Drogovic just won Formula 2. You've got Enzo Fittipaldi doing a great job, Cal Collet in F3 as well. Who do you think is going to be the next Brazilian driver to make it into
F1? There was a Brazilian driver that won the go-kart world championship also.
There you go.
Yeah. Morgato is his name. He's a bit older. He's probably not going to go to single-seaters, but he won the world championship. A great talent as well. There is a couple of guys. There is... Rafael Câmara as well in Formula 4 or Italian Formula 4, something like this. It's hard to say. Not every good go-kart driver becomes a very good car driver, although you need to be at least in a certain level, but of course it does not really represent. Some drivers are extremely good at the beginning of their single-seater career, and then they don't develop further when they are in a two Formula One. And sometimes it's the other way around, like Vettel, for example. He was never outstanding in the junior series, but when he got the Formula One chance, he was outstanding and he stayed there. He had this amazing career, and probably one of the best drivers that has ever lived in F1. So it's very hard to say. I think all of these names that you said, they have the potential and they have the talent to be in the Formula One grid. They are probably more talented than a couple of drivers that are there already, or they are there now.
Yep.
Will they become world champions or come to win races, or they will never have the chance to drive Formula One? That would be due to timing. That would be due to some... partial luck and some partial political decisions, financial decisions. So it's very hard to pin it down to talent. Talent, I think all of them they will have talent to be on the grid in Formula One at one stage of their career.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it all pans out. I'm pleased for Drugovich, though. I think it's deserved.
Definitely. He's a great kid, and Formula 2 is expensive. And you can see, it's not that he has the infinite financial background to do whatever he wants. He needed to deliver. He had a lot of pressure. He took the risk, and he delivered what he needed this year. So I think not only he should be very proud of himself, and Brazil is very proud to have him the first Formula 2 champion. I was vice champion. Piquet was vice champion. Senna was vice champion. Nars, I think, was vice champion as well. It's the first time that we have a Brazilian champion. So he's well-deserved, and congratulations to him.
Absolutely. And he's worked hard to get there, hasn't he? He's been at it very hard for a few years. And Piquet, of course. We had Piquet on the podcast. Man, that guy can talk. Jeez, he just went on and on and on and on and on. But listen, Lucas, we've kept you long enough. We'll let you get on with your day. But absolutely fascinating chat. I think this has got to be one of my favourites so far. We've done well over 100 episodes, and I love going deep into a subject. And the whole sustainability and climate change area is truly fascinating. Best of luck with all your efforts in that regard. Of course, best of luck with Mahindra in season 9 in the new Gen 3 car. We can't wait to see how you get on there. But for now, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day and joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Tim, for having me here. Tom, also, thanks very much for the time. And it has been a big, big pleasure. I hope we had another hour to talk about so many other subjects. It has been a great time. Thank you very much.
We'll have to do round 2 because we haven't even got onto the scooters yet. So there's plenty more.
Definitely, then we talk about
this. Yeah, okay, good stuff. Well, until Lucas Degrassi 2.0, thanks for joining us. See you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.